We don't even have to be talking about setbacks or relapses in order for substance use to be killing people.
Right.
It could be the first time that they use it. It could be the 10th time. It could be that they've been in recovery for 10 years and decide to use again. The drugs out there today that are laced with all that they are and as heavy and strong as they are are causing deaths. Do I need a stronger word than overdose? Death is about as strong as it gets.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. I feel like Sarah would judge me for that intro. People of the earth, if you have ears, may you hear. This is the Most High Show, and today we are talking about CARES. That is an acronym. Is that the word, acronym?
Mm-hmm.
And it is Certified Addiction Recovery Empowerment Specialist. And CARES was developed by the Georgia Council for Recovery to create a workforce of peers to provide recovery support services to the communities of Georgia, funded by Georgia's Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities. The CARES Academy is the first of its kind in the country to be to be Medicaid billable. Okay. So CARES Academy, just kind of giving you a little peek on this. If someone takes a CARES Academy, they are become an advocate for recovery themselves, the peers with whom they work with, their recovery community, and the recovery-oriented system of care. They can run recovery groups using Partners for Change Outcome Management System. That's how it's worded. It's got the system.
Okay.
Yeah. An evidence-based practice found on the SAMHSA National Registry of Evidence-Based Practices and Programs. We're going to be talking a little bit about that. We have some questions. And with us is an actual CARES specialist. And our guest today, sitting in the decadent seat of service, and she's been hanging out here for a while. We've been having a good time. Fred's here. E-Man's on the ones and twos. Chad is co-hosting. My name is Christian. And in the seat of service is Dawn. And Dawn is a certified addiction recovery empowerment specialist since 2015.
Yes.
Working for Georgia Council Recovery as an education and training manager. And previously, as the Emergency Department Recovery Coach Program Manager. So you know, when you have that many words in your title, this is a real deal.
Okay.
Yes. In partnership with Northeast Georgia Health System, Dawn is also a Certified Peer Specialist, CPS. That was back in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Mental health.
Mental health. And also a recovery coaching certification through Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery. That's in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So, everybody, please welcome Dawn to the Most High Show.
Yay. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Fred.
All right. So, that was a lot of information up top.
Yeah.
But, Dawn, just tell us in your own words what. So, there's Georgia Council for Recovery. What is that?
Georgia Council for Recovery, formerly known as the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse, is the state's largest recovery community organization in Georgia. They spearhead, they started out really small and now have spearheaded so many recovery movements in different settings in Georgia that now we have helped create over 47 RCOs in Georgia. We are the state trainer.
Now, what's an RCO?
Recovery Community Organization.
Okay.
Like you were talking about recovery-oriented systems of care.
Yeah.
A Recovery Community Organization, or an ARSC as they're called now, Addiction Recovery Service Center, is where people can go to fellowship, to find a peer coach, to have their needs met at whatever specific things that RCO does.
Yeah.
Also, the Georgia Council is the state trainer for the CARE certification. We also have the Warm Line. We also have direct services inside Northeast Georgia. We do. We also work with research projects with Emory and Grady, with Augusta University, with Mercer. We're hosting ARAD January 21st. So how much more can I tell you about the council?
Yeah.
And I'm the education and training manager.
Yeah. That's amazing. And so for the steppers out there, I like to kind of like, an RCO is kind of like, it's kind of like a clubhouse,
mm-hmm.
right? You go there, you show up there. There's usually going to be meetings there. There'll be people maybe hanging out there. Maybe someone's there manning the table or the phones. And if you need help, one of these RCOs is a great place to start.
Yes.
Because either they'll help you right then and there, or if you need additional services or higher level of care, they can certainly connect you to other things in that community, right?
Right, because they're also connected to all the other RCOs in the state. And so there's just limitless or whatever Georgia offers resources at the table for any RCO.
So I wrote in here, you've been sober, but I know that that's not what everyone says. And some people might say you've been clean.
Get it right.
Yeah, some people might.
Some people might say you've maintained your recovery.
Thank you.
Since 2007.
That's correct.
So if you would, just kind of give us a high level of what that pathway was. What was your personal pathway to maintaining recovery and getting to the place now where you're giving back and serving and empowering other individuals?
Okay, so without going to the backdrop pre-2007, my pathway to recovery was self-direction, was self-awareness, and was peer support. It was peer support that, I had been abstinent from using substances prior to having mental health challenges. And so it was peer support for mental health challenges, suicidal ideations, impact of diagnoses, and so forth. And when I learned of CPSMH and that there was a place I could go to speak with people that were on the peer level, that were not clinical or any medical model, all of a sudden I felt very normal for feeling abnormal for so long. And it wasn't long before I trained to be a CPS mental health and started working as a CPS mental health.
Yeah.
After that, I went on to achieve my CARES. But when it comes to using substances, my pathway to quitting everything was cold turkey. Mm. It never occurred to me, not once, while I was feeling bad from withdrawals from methamphetamine or cocaine, it never occurred to me to call 911. It never occurred to me to go to the hospital. That's why it gave me great reward and gratitude to be a recovery coach in the emergency department, because it's something I never thought of doing. So I was really glad that I was able to be a part of someone who did think to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you think it never occurred to you to do that?
Probably because I'd never heard it done before.
Yeah.
I mean, I have heard of people being in car accidents or having a gunshot wound or having an overdose or something traumatically happening to them that took them to the hospital. But I'd never heard anyone went to the hospital because they were in withdrawal from some kind of substance.
Yeah.
Never.
So is there like a system set up in hospitals then when if somebody was to show up in that state? In that state of mind or in a withdrawal state of mind and they show up to a hospital, are there protocols that hospitals have to be able to deal with that?
Well, each hospital has its own protocols, but when they join with recovery coaches and bring them on board to work inside of their ED, then the protocols change, of course, and then the recovery coaches have their own set of professional and working on someone else's turf, so to say, professional protocols to follow.
Okay.
So, yeah, there's all there's training for that. There's protocols in place. There's agreements and service agreements within the hospitals, memorandums. There's red tape in the political stuff we were talking about earlier that does go into place
but
first.
But it gives you, and this is probably an initiative of Georgia Council, right, to be, or and the individual RCOs, to get peer support specialists or CARES people into the hospitals. So when someone shows up with this very specific issue, they have a peer that they can immediately be connected to.
Yes, that's if the hospital is ready to, you know, work alongside the RCOs.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's so relatively new. There are quite a few states that have started it across the nation. But, you know, in Georgia, I think now, because we're also doing it virtually as well, meeting with a peer specialist on a computer virtually in your emergency department. So, you know, I think there might be six hospitals involved
in Georgia now.
In Georgia at this current moment.
Yeah, and in your bio, it says that you were the emergency department recovery coach program manager.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just tell me, like, the simple version of what that means?
Well, that means that I had experience being a peer specialist and a recovery coach. I had a perfect understanding of, you know, what goes into recovery coaching as well as the professionalism in working in a different organization, being a vendor.
Right.
But I think mainly, you know, when you have experience and you can help a pilot project start to build into a replicable program. I think that I had a set of skills that Neil Campbell from our previous executive director, Larissa Guerrero, my supervisor at the time, found would be beneficial in putting me in that position. And then we had, you know, 6 to 7 recovery coaches that were being managed at any given time, which I want to say, and I just want to plug this in right quick. This program in the emergency department spun off other recovery coach programs with inside the same hospital system, NICU. So, and then alcohol use disorder only, and then with DFACS and prenatal. And so, you know, there's a lot to be said about witnessing, and Northeast Georgia witnessed the culture shift, and then other departments wanted recovery coaches in their organization.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I mean, after a while, you can't help but notice, like, a lot of these issues are stemming from substance use disorder, right? Or a lot of people in jails or who are incarcerated, a lot of their crimes are committed either under the influence or under the search of getting more drugs. And so I think the system that is starting to see, okay, the issue seems to be the substance use or alcohol use, and that's what's really the underlying cause that's creating all this stuff. So if we treat that, then that'll help us, right? And it probably, like in NICU and in all these instances, it'll help them, you know, lower their caseload, hopefully, right?
Well, that, you know, lower the cost, lower the repetitive visits. I can point out, because this is one of the things we like to brag about the most, is that for a newborn baby that was born with drugs or opiates in their system, usually took 39 days they spent in the NICU. After having recovery coaches implemented and having the nurses there in the women's pavilion and the recovery coaches themselves gravitate together and come up with new ways to console the infant, the newborn, the stay was reduced to 9 days.
Oh, wow.
So that's a lot of savings. That's a lot of savings. That's a lot of good health for the baby. And also, you know, medicated assisted treatment to start. You can start while in your pregnancy. There's just so much. You know, I can go down many rabbit holes, as I told y'all earlier, about what the council has done and started and what recovery coaches are good for.
Yeah. And I guess a part of that is the awareness, right? It's letting people know, like what you said, like medically assisted, what do you call it?
Treatment.
Treatment
mm-hmm.
can be started while pregnant.
Right, and a lot of people don't know that. And medicated assisted treatment wasn't going very far, maybe say a year and a half ago, because of the X waiver, and that was for doctors and physicians, and now that has been released. So,
what's the X waiver?
An X waiver is some kind of certification that PhDs had to get in order to prescribe medication assisted treatment.
Oh,
they shouldn't call it that, the X waiver. That sounds terrible.
That sounds like something a no. Bad.
I don't like that, but that's cool that that's no longer a thing. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was a thing they had to get some sort of certification to be able to prescribe these things.
Sure, and now that's gone.
Yeah, they could prescribe everything else, though.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Good point.
Yeah. So talking, like, personally, right, for you, it seems like you caught on pretty quickly to wanting to get involved in the solution, right? What do you think was it like behind that for you personally, and how has that contributed to you continuing and maintaining your recovery?
Well, you know, it's not hard to answer. It's just hard to put into words that, you know, are always so appropriate. But to, as much as you love those around you that are trying to support you and trying to help you and what you should do, and that's not always the key to work. What works. And when you search inside yourself and ask, you know, what is going to work, for me, I had made up my mind that this isn't the life that I wanted, but it was peer support for mental health when that brought me into the awareness that there wasn't as much wrong with me as I had previously and always thought that there was.
Mm.
You know, and we're talking about in the 35, 36-year age range that I'm becoming, this is an epiphany.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine if I caught it in my 20s.
Right.
Right. But so from there on, I was free to be me, but I was free to be me in the confines of what benefits my future. So my everything pathway to recovery is self-care, self-awareness, self-direction, self-decisions, boundaries. And then that's when I decided, you know, if my non-conforming, tough self can get this down.
That's a good job of filtering what you wanted to
Thank
say.
You.
Yes. Fantastic.
Thank you. I worked on that one for 10 minutes. But yeah. No, I knew that if hard-headedness and just dead set, you know, I knew if I could do it, that if support was offered to people, they also could do it. And if they didn't want it right then, you've already planted the seed.
Yeah.
They know someone's out there somewhere.
Right, they know it exists. Mm-hmm. And we were talking before the show, and you told me the semi-technical term for peer support. What was it?
Yeah, technical. So technically, you know, when people say, define peer support for me, you know, and it's an authentic, unique relationship that's mutually beneficial between two individuals. I mean, that's what peer support means. I'm here to learn from you. I'm not here to fix you. I'm here to understand what makes you use or what made you use. I can't assume, you know.
Right.
So that mutual beneficial part is me learning you while you're learning me. We're sharing our lived experience, but we want to mainly focus on sharing what helped us get well.
Yeah. Sharing solution.
Right.
Yeah. I imagine that goes into kind of what the training is doing, right? When they're, can you tell us a little bit, like, how extensive is the training for to become, if you want, someone want to say, I want to become a CARES person, what would be required of them?
Well, the first thing someone might say to someone is a ROSC workshop, which is Recovery Oriented Systems of Care, which you read earlier. So,
ROSC. I got
right.
it.
Right. There you go. So take a ROSC workshop, learn what's expected of the application process and what they're looking for. Then you would apply.
Yeah.
Then, and about 120 to 150 people apply per training. The good news is starting in 2024, our trainings went from 4 trainings a year to 9.
Wow.
So we have that many people trying to get in. So once you do a ROSC workshop, it can be in person or online. Go to the Georgia Council for Recovery site to find that. Learn what's expected. Apply. They will be in contact with you. And, you know, and don't be dismayed or disheartened if you don't get in the first time. There is a lot of people out there applying to become CARE certified and get into the CARES workforce.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I imagine once you're in the training, you're learning, like, listening skills, mirroring skills, mm-hmm. kind of coaching mechanisms and ways to...
But you're learning them in a non-clinical sense.
Yeah.
You're learning them in a peer support fashion. So the first day you're having welcome in and introductions, which you're going to hear a lot of people come in, give their elevator speech, which I did not do here tonight. I'd be more than happy to, though. And you learn and hear about other people's recovery stories. Then you go into the motivational interviewing. I think that's a day and a half.
Yeah.
We go into recovery language. What does recovery language sound like? What are good peer support ethics and boundaries? And then you also formulate your elevator speech so that you can advocate in 30 seconds with anybody that you might run into.
Yeah. So what's your elevator?
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Dawn Molinax, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. What that means for me, it's been 17 years since I've found the need to use illicit drugs to deal with my emotions, such as major depressive disorder. I'm committed to my recovery today because it's given me a life of self-direction, and I'm able to do what's best for me for my future. I continue to work in this field because I hope that everyone has a chance to meet a recovery coach, be supported, and get well.
Okay. Mm. All right.
I'm sold.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's in 30 seconds, I can say that anywhere to anyone, and hopefully it will invoke questions of tell me more.
Yeah.
So
sure. When someone's going through this training, how did they develop the training? Like, how did they come up with this?
So George Brought and Neil Campbell, George Brought, who I could go into all of his letters, is one of our, he's the founder of CARES and developed the training manual himself along with Neil Campbell. And the great things that are required, you know, motivational interviewing is the skill that we use the most, and it's a very good skill. You can use it with your kids, you can use it in real life, but motivational interviewing really helps for you to pull stuff out of a person without you having to say much to them.
Yeah.
What brings you into the emergency department today? And they would just start telling me.
Right.
I don't walk in with any assumptions or agendas.
You don't come in and go, damn.
Yeah, well, I have, yeah.
Oh, boy, you look like you need help. Okay, so these people kind of created this system based on probably years of experience and clinical studies and all this stuff
and
about what really works.
They were also in the pioneering process of peer support in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Yes.
So... you know, there's a lot of similarities. I am a person in long-term recovery, but I'm also a 12-stepper,
mm-hmm.
right? And there are so many similarities to essentially when you're describing all of this, you could be describing a healthy 12-step community,
surely.
Right? Which is peer-based. It is, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'll tell you how I did it and how I got past this.
Which is how it was developed by Bill Wilson,
yeah,
right.
So there's a lot of similarities.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? And there's also obvious conflicts.
Sure.
Between this CARES. I think a lot of it comes out of the recovery language, right? A lot mm-hmm. of people get stuck on this recovery language. But there are so many similarities to that. Do you think, I mean, I guess I don't know how, I don't want to put you on the spot, but like, do you think that Because 12 steps is an abstinence model, and that's a pretty clear line, right? Do you think that what is being developed was in response to maybe some of the issues that people were having in 12 steps? Because for years, 12 steps was the primary peer support.
So if I'm understanding you, using motivational interviewing here, if I'm hearing you correctly, are you asking if peer support or care certification was created from people not being feeling comfortable in AA?
Yeah.
I have to say no.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think the where they saw the need for? Because anything government involved, right? I don't know about you, but me, immediately my ears go up. Okay, what are y'all trying to do here?
Sure.
Right? I'd like to think that Georgia as a state saw its citizens struggling at a mass level and said, we need to figure out a way to do this. And here is a brilliant method to do it without dumping, you know, billions of dollars into the system, mm-hmm. right? Let's empower all these people who have experienced life change and then figure out a way to get them in the community.
Right. So becoming a CARES is very empowering. That's why it's in the title.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's really, talking about the animosity range and the language and all of that,
yeah.
When it comes to a CARES, you know, there are a lot of 12-steppers that are CARES.
Yeah.
The difference between being an open CARES and being an AA goer is the anonymous piece.
Yeah.
You know? So that's where I want to go with that, because for me, if I'm going to a meeting, and you go to meetings, you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. But if I just am saying it in general, no one knows what that means.
Yeah.
But if I'm saying I'm a person in recovery and I'm going to go deal with, you know, my all recovery meeting right now, I'm not being anonymous about my recovery. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I think
that's also in the elevator pitch, right? Because the elevator pitch is designed to where it doesn't, you don't have to be a person who has substance use disorder to understand what you're saying.
Right, say sure.
It, right? Whereas, like, if I say I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict, someone who doesn't have that issue might go, like, you don't, what? You,
right.
You have a house? What is wrong with you? Right.
I appreciate you bringing this up, because someone told me the other day, well, you know, if I can't 12-step with my peer, then, you know, but we both go to the same meeting and yeah, you know, I start asking them, well, what hat are you wearing?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're wearing your CARES hat and you're using your recovery language, way to go. If you're at your 12-step meeting because that's your pathway and you're a sponsor, and then you're going to use their language, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you really need to think about your setting and what audience that you're tailoring to and what hat you're wearing, because, like, for me, like we were talking earlier too, sometimes I have to remember what my job is and what my life is.
Yeah.
Same difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I did the training for the language training, so I was doing some speaking thing. And I remember clearly, like,
the recovery messaging?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember them saying, like, look, I remember whoever the instructor was is saying, you know, we're not telling you you can't self-identify how you identify when you're in your environment.
Sure.
Right? Like, we're saying when you're going to be in a public setting and you're going to be speaking to people, or you might be at a, you know, a mixed crowd, this is the way to introduce yourself, because we found that this offers more connection points.
Right.
For you to be helpful.
Right.
And I thought that was really, you know, I'm glad I took that training, and I'm glad that they said that, because I think that's what a lot of the language thing. I mean, language is so important to us, right? I mean, I don't know why, but we love words. And you got to use the right words. Right.
Right.
And oh my gosh, you didn't use the right words. But it's such a hang up for people. And I think that that's where the kind of the a big disconnect comes from.
Mm-hmm. Right? That's also where a lot of stigma comes from and judgment and bias. Exactly. And we don't even know that we're doing that.
Right.
You know, so that's one of the large premises put on recovery language and utilizing it, is because when we're out speaking in public with the Georgia Council for Recovery, or, you know, I'm here today on my own accord, but representing the Georgia Council, I want to be heard as a non-stigmatizing, non-judgmental person. Yeah. Now, when I go down the road and, you know, people start cutting me off, that's a whole different, you know.
That's a different dawn.
But you see what I'm saying? The language has to do with how does everyone in the room feel comfortable without, you know, us reinforcing stigma.
Yeah, and I think that's also probably comes from the motivational interviewing,
mm-hmm.
and just the whole approach as a whole, right? Or kind of positive psychology methods.
Yeah, I love that.
And ways of, like, rather than focusing on the negatives.
What's right with you? We start every meeting. What's right with you today, Chad?
Yeah, right.
Do you have a what's right with you?
What's right with you?
What's right with me today?
Yeah.
Y'all really put me on the spot. I have a job. You're welcome. I have a home. I have a car. I have a beautiful woman at home. I hope she's watching. Hey, Alyssa, I love you.
You got a good beard.
You got a nice beard.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. I've been trying to. I've been growing this beard for 9 months. This is what I got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when you talk to people like that, and we do start our meetings like that, sometimes I start my trainings like that. It's not just to be Pollyanna or all positive all the time. It's just like, let's divert from, oh, this is boring, I don't want to be here, to, hey, what's right with you, Christian?
Right.
You know?
Because I think there is, number one, humans are negative. There's a negative bias in the human brain, right? Like, that's proven by neuroscience, mm-hmm. right, that we have a negative bias. And I think those people I know, to use your language, who have substance use disorder or alcohol use disorder, we're all pretty negative. It's easy to be negative.
It's easy to be cynical when you get older, too, you know, but it's like, where do we...
So we need that reframing consistently, right? And
sure.
I think that's where good peers and good fellowship and like-minded individuals, you know, I know that when I call and I complain, there are sometimes when I know whoever I'm calling to or talking to, sometimes they know I just need to vent.
Right.
I need to get this out. And then sometimes they know, because we've developed a relationship, okay, you need to be reminded that everything is not, the sky isn't falling.
Right.
You are not a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
You are a beautiful human who's finding his way through life. And without, that's what's the beauty about peer support,
because
mm-hmm. peers can do that. We can remind each other of these things, right?
Yeah. And sometimes a phone call will start out with, I just need to vent.
Yeah.
And you're like, got it.
Yeah.
You know, so you're over here multitasking while someone's venting, but then it's like, no, I'm really having trouble, you know, or I'm really thinking this, and okay.
Yeah. A call today was, I need your input on something,
mm-hmm.
which is an invitation to say, okay, I would like to know what you think about.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did life coaching training, and that was a lot of what they taught, right?
Right.
Was that. And I remember the teacher telling me, Christian, it's going to be really interesting to see how you do with this coaching with your codependency issues.
With wanting to fix everything?
I watched that earlier.
Yeah.
What?
When I was making the...
Oh, you watched me share that?
I watched the podcast. Yeah, I was like, oh.
Oh, yeah.
That is interesting.
Oh, she saw it on me.
I watched
it. And immediately after that training, I was like, I need to... This is clearly something, right? And so now it is, I wait for that invite. Because it is hard to offer help to someone who's not asking for help. Because it doesn't work out for anyone.
But you can ask if they want it,
too.
You know, that's the mutual part.
Yeah.
Right. You know? Yeah. It's like, do you really want to know what I think? Or, you know, do you really want help? When I'd go in the emergency, I mean, I really ask people, do you want recovery? Do you really want it? Do you really want support with it?
Yeah.
You know? And I've had people all over the spectrum, you know, get the out and no and yes and no and yes and no. But those people will always remember that you asked.
Yeah.
And they'll call you back.
Sure. Yeah. So I'd like to talk a little bit with you about the way that we've looked at and treated I like how you have it out like you read it. Like you've read it. You just look down at it.
He's making sure I'm answering right.
But, you know, when the 12-step fellowship, the first fellowship was created, it was pretty groundbreaking that it looked at alcoholism as a disease. It was revolutionary. Up until that point, it was a moral issue, simply, right? And so that was the first time in the American culture that those kind of behaviors were looked at as, oh, this is a disease. And then I think the medical field began to catch on to it. And so it seems like we're evolving in the way that we talk about addiction, the way we talk about substance use disorder, and the way we treat it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do see that that's what...
Well, it's funny that you say that, because wasn't that in 1935?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're in what, 2024?
Yeah.
I literally just finished a training on the science of addiction and recovery. I'm still training and teaching people how substances affect the brain and how it is a disease. Right. And, you know, sometimes I'll put people on the spot and be like, how many people here think that addiction is a disease? And no one raises their hand. And I'm like, well, we're in for a long training.
Right.
Right. But, you know, when you think about everything that you put in your body, food, carrots, coffee, everything you put in your body goes to every organ because why? It travels through your blood. But, you know, when alcoholism or substance use or food or gambling or sex or anything hijacks that central part of your brain that feels like it needs it for life, that is a disease. That's not a moral failing.
Right. Yeah, and even with some of the more process-oriented addictions, right, like gambling or sex or relationships, we call it, you go into the internal drugstore
because
you don't need to ingest anything. For some, they can think about it. Just the thought of, and process addiction is very different from chemical addiction. But because you don't need anything outside of yourself to begin to get high, in a sense, right?
Right. Well, yeah. And some people call that pre-setback or relapse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just think going into that space. But yeah.
So, okay, can I have an honest conversation with you about the language of relapse and setback?
Yes, you may.
Okay. So
thanks for asking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks
and Chad,
for
you can
thank Chad, you, Chad, for having my back.
Hit me with these flowers if I go too far. No,
let's sit.
So I love the idea, first off, of a setback. I like it because it is what it is. Let's move forward, right? Which is essentially how I would handle any person who comes to me and who has had a setback. Right. But on the other end, the language of just setback also sounds too nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it is a life or death decision for a lot of people. What I'm asking you, but I'd love to talk about that and talk about that through. Like, I see the value of calling something a setback because it does allow someone the ability to, all right, let's bounce back. But if somebody is, you know, potentially putting their life or the life of other people in danger, is setback strong enough of language?
Well, honest conversation here.
Yes.
How is relapse any less strong or stronger than setback when it comes to life or death?
I think because of the stigma of relapse.
Okay.
Right? There's the stigma of associated with relapse is, especially in like the 12-step community, right?
Mm-hmm.
When someone says you've relapsed, it means, oh, you got to go get a white chip.
White.
You got to start your recovery over.
But, stigma. Okay. So for a peer specialist and a true peer recovery coach that understands and a person having a setback, for me personally, this is all a personal, because we were talking about how I really stopped in 97, but I had a lengthy setback in 2007. That was a 10-month setback. That's a real true setback to me.
Yeah.
Someone who's just thinking about something is not a setback. It's a pre-contemplation towards that. But we don't even have to be talking about setbacks or relapses in order for substance use to be killing people.
Right.
It could be the first time that they use it. It could be the 10th time. It could be that they've been in recovery for 10 years and decide to use again. The drugs out there today that are laced with all that they are and as heavy and strong as they are are causing deaths. Do I need a stronger word than overdose? Death is about as strong as it gets.
Yeah.
So, and I've said that training emergency department physician assistants or people becoming emergency, that overdose really, when we look at overdose, people think of having a relapse or setback because the next question they ask is, did they live? So if we always looked at overdose as a death, you know, is there a word to put on the severity of having a setback or a relapse? I think not. I think having an unfortunate substance use situation from somebody selling you something that will kill you, and it does, is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Is that an honest enough commute?
Yeah.
I mean, you may.
No, you handled
it. If you disagree with me, bring it, you know?
No, but I mean, I see things. I think I've learned through my own recovery journey that things are very much, a lot of things are paradoxical, right?
And exactly.
Things can be
twisted.
Yep. Things can be both at the same time, right? And I do. Especially when it comes to recovery language, I see the value in both.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I totally do. But I just felt like that was an important conversation to have for people because some people really, I think, from any side, you know, working together. Like you said, there's so many 12-steppers who have become
cares.
Mm-hmm. And they know how to handle that and deal with that. Right, because they know when I'm in a care setting, I'm operating under these guidelines. I need to operate under this.
I have people that just say, I'm going to say the word sober, Don, shut up. You know, I'm going to use the word sober. And I'm like, well, I don't care, use the word sober. But every time you say sober, I'm going to say recovery. And they're just like, you know, but I mean, it really comes down to who's the audience that you're talking to, what hat are you wearing, and really what's the point you're trying to get across.
There it is, yeah. What are you trying? Are you trying to be helpful?
What are you trying to say?
Yeah.
We don't want people to die. We don't want people to die from using, going back to use, substance use, beginning to use. Yeah. Who cares if you call it setback or relapse? The fact is, we don't want people dying from using substances or alcohol.
Shout out Jeff for. I asked Jeff who would be a good person to come on the bring on to the
Shout
show.
Shout out Jeff Breedlove.
Shout out Breedlove.
Yeah.
Because we need it. We wanted to, and that's what I think we need to have, like this honest conversation, because I think, like it or not, this is their direction, and it's good. I think a lot of other states are doing very similar things, right? And they have different acronyms who they're certifying, but the idea of empowering people to be in those front lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
It said here somewhere in the outline, correct if I'm wrong, that Georgia is the highest ranking or the leader in the
peer support realm.
In the state. I mean, in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we started grassroots early. And we just have so many different programs going. We have 1,500 CARES certified to date. We have over almost 5,000 CPS mental health. We're trying to catch up with that forensically. We also have peer support for youth, and we also, the Georgia Parent Support Network also certifies parents, you know, to help be less nagging and more helpful to help their child.
Yeah. All right. So you said forensic. So tell us, what's the forensic?
Forensic is for people that have been incarcerated or imprisoned, to support people that are coming out of incarceration or imprisonment and reintegrating into society.
Yeah. So again, it's shared experience, shared life experience.
But that's what the substance use realm in there as well.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And then that's very interesting about the parents.
Yep.
Yeah. So there is a training that a parent can take to learn how to help other parents navigate these situations.
And help their own family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Georgia Parent Support Network. I just did a training for them a couple weeks ago on the science of addiction and recovery.
And so they would go to the same place, the Georgia Council for Recovery, to find information on that, or?
They could. There's probably a link there, but they're their own separate entity, Georgia Parent Support Network. And then our sister, which is the pioneer of peer support in Georgia, is the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network. And that's where I got my start, and they do the training for CPS mental health.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
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 So that was two. You named about five.
I told you.
You mentioned forensics. And the parent, the
so formal. For forensics is Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network also.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With George Braugh, again, who I talked about, developed the CARES training.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then what about for the youth?
For the youth, I believe it's through the Georgia Parent Support Network. And people that are recovery coaches age 18 to 24, it might be 26, can help support youth. Anybody that's just a regular CARES cannot support anyone under the age of 18.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's amazing, too. It's hard to think of, like, anyone under 18 already kind of living this experience.
Really?
Coming to a place of clarity and then living.
Oh, and being able to help other youth, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's a quick turnaround.
I know it.
Well, I mean, I think in our direct services in Gainesville, I think one of the youngest people we have employed there now is 23 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Amazed, mind blown. And I every time I meet a young person in recovery, I tell them thank you, and I tell them how I admire them, because to have that decision, to make that decision to not want to stay on substances or alcohol or use them throughout the duration of your life is just admirable to me.
Yeah.
I thought every 20-year-old did it till they were at least 35.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
So yeah. They don't do that?
They don't do that anymore. Oh,
I do think, and I think you're right, like there's, even on here on Friday nights, there's a lot more people, I mean tonight, not tonight, cause it's too cold outside, but there are a lot more young people in the early 20s who are showing up, and it's beautiful to see them getting it. You know, I think I started this recovery journey at 33, and I feel like I just got it, you know. I mean, I maintained my recovery.
You could say it however you'd like,
Christian. No, I'm trying, I'm doing the language. I maintained my recovery, but I've been crazy, you know. And to see young people really kind of, what you said, like knowledge of self, the self-direction, the ability to know when you're deluding yourself at that level, at that age, it's amazing to think, wow, if you stay
on
this path.
They have a lot of self-care.
Yes.
Yeah, the younger generation has a lot of, you know, we didn't do self-care. Why? Because then it was considered, you know, hoity-toity or whatever.
Right,
but they have a lot of care about their bodies, their image, their success, and I think a lot of that drives it, and I'm glad for it. You know, how are we going to keep that going? And hopefully it's going to be those that pick up that torch that are in the age bracket to help us.
Yeah.
For sure.
Nobody wants to hear from me at a high school, you know what I'm saying?
you need people who can...
They can relate to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Their own peers. To.
Yeah. We did those for a while. We did high school stuff and would do these big, like, assemblies and... And I always just, something about it, I just didn't feel right. I just felt like it's too, because I think like what I felt in these, like doing these assemblies was.
The DARE program. Don't do drugs, kid.
Yeah, I was a child of DARE.
Me too.
It's like, here's this extreme example. And it's so easy for a young person to go, oh, well, I'm not doing that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Never going to do that.
I'm never going to do that.
Yeah.
Like, that's so far out there. That's not me, right? Yeah. And so they can think that, well, I can continue using recreationally, and that's just not an option at this, in today, in the way drugs are, recreational drug use is not an option anymore.
Yeah, we have that factor that we in the early 90s didn't have. And that was the fatal fentanyl and carfentanil and mm-hmm. all of that, xylazine, that's just in everything, including your marijuana or vape oils or whatever. Like, that was unheard of. Mm-hmm. So I think that they also are very aware at the severity and the seriousness of not to trust someone handing you substances.
Yeah.
I'm just going to give them a lot of credit.
Yeah. No, I'm with it. I love it. So you're in this decadent state of service. So I don't know if you want to. I'd love for this to come from you, Dawn.
Okay.
We always ask, what would you like to say to someone who might be on the other side of this publication, this debauchery, and say, what would you say to someone who's like, they're at that place where they're like, how I'm living isn't working anymore, and I want to change, and I don't know how to do it, I don't know what to do, and I don't know if I'm worth it, I don't know if I should. What would you say to somebody in that state?
Well, I would say to that person that, you know, while I don't know how you feel exactly, I bet you I'm pretty close to knowing how you feel. I've felt worthless. I've been full of self-loathing, have low self-image, feel lonely at times. But if this isn't the road that you want to go down, and I'm hard-headed, I thought I could just fix everything by myself, please ask for what you need. And where do we start? We don't know. You know, what's the situation, Christian? Are we standing at McDonald's in this weather? Mm. You know, are we standing in the emergency department where they're getting medical care? Mm. You know, are we just talking with someone at a 12-step meeting? I mean, what's the setting? Mm-hmm. And what do you want from me? Mm-hmm. When I run into peer support and I could get them to listen to what was hurting my heart and all the things that I wanted to change about myself, and to hear that, you know, those are doable things, that really sparked my interest in, okay, how? And so brainstorming is a part of peer support. So what's the first step you want to be different? Mm. Well, I'm freezing my ass off. I'd like to get out of the cold. You know, we want to do everything we can to find some shelter. Which, you know, the five things that people need the most are also the same five things that are lacking the most. Yeah. So people don't feel worthy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know that I like instant gratification. I wished I had a magic wand. But getting to where you want to go takes time. But getting out of this immediate situation is only a step away, you know?
Clip it.
That. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
Anything else from you, Chad, before we close up?
I don't think so. We talked for 2 hours before the show started. I think I asked all my questions prematurely, so.
That's why that's why I walked out of the room, because I'm like, okay, I don't want to like have this conversation yet. I mean, I want to do it on the show. So, thank you, Dawn.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Being so authentic, for having this conversation, and for what I think you're repping Georgia Council so well, and for all the service and everything that you do.
Thank
and all
you.
The training. And so let's give a round of applause for Dawn and for the Most High Show.
All right, Most High Show.
All right. Thank you, our donors and supporters, and we are out.